resistant, jam resistant satellite communication system known as the Advanced Extremely High Frequency System. The NORAD Command Center connects to its partner facility. But the SECDEF and the chairman are not quite inside the bunker beneath the Pentagon. Not yet. 2 minutes, National Military Command Center, Pentagon. 2 minutes have passed. Two men move briskly through the Pentagon, running, not jogging, across the E-rings, high-shined, linoleum-tiled floors. One, the Secretary of Defense, wears a business suit, white shirt, and tie. The other, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is in military dress, resplendent with stars and bars and ribbons. Each man moves quickly down multiple sets of stairs, through fire doors, down more stairs, through more doors, and into a high-security tunnel that leads into the National Military Command Center. Here, the nation's STRATCOM and NORAD commanders wait on satellite comms and video screens for the president's two most senior advisors. If STRATCOM and NORAD are the brain and the brainstem of nuclear war, the National Military Command Center beneath the Pentagon is the beating heart of nuclear World War III. Originally called the War Room, this command post was first conceived for the Pentagon in 1948 as a place to run the next world war. It has been in use 24/7, 365, every day of every year, ever since. 2 minutes have now passed since detected launch. The SECDEF and the chairman arrive just seconds apart. Via secure satellite video comms from Colorado, the NORAD commander speaks. His assessment is brief and to the point. Tracking data has confirmed a worst-case scenario. An attacking intercontinental ballistic missile is on its way to the east coast of the United States. History lesson number two, the ICBM, 26 minutes, 40 seconds to Armageddon. An intercontinental ballistic missile is a long-range missile that delivers nuclear weapons to targets across continents. ICBMs exist to kill millions of people on another side of the world. Back in 1960, when the ICBM had just been invented, the Pentagon's chief scientist, a man named Herb York, wanted to know precisely how many minutes it would take for one of these mass extermination rockets to get from a launch pad in Soviet Russia to a city in the United States. York hired a group of defense scientists called the Jason Scientists to whittle that number down to its most accurate form. The result, Herb York learned, was 26 minutes and 40 seconds from launch to annihilation. Just 1,600 seconds. That is it. A copy of this secret assessment lies hidden among Herb York's personal papers at the Geisel Library in San Diego. Perhaps York left it there out of carelessness, or maybe he wanted the world to know for certain what war planners and weapons builders have known for decades, but have never revealed in such cold, hard terms, that there is no way to win a nuclear war. It simply happens too fast. The speed at which nuclear war will unfold and then escalate all but guarantees that it will end in nuclear holocaust. The nuclear-armed ICBM threatens us with annihilation, York wrote. The outlook is admittedly bleak. The Jason scientists calculated that an ICBM's 26 minutes and 40 seconds of travel time occurs in three phases of flight. Boost phase, which lasts 5 minutes. Mid-course phase, which lasts 20 minutes. Terminal phase, which lasts 1.6 minutes, 100 seconds. The 5 minute long boost phase includes the time it takes for the missile to ignite its rocket motors on the launch pad, head into space, and finish powered flight. After powered flight, the warhead is released, typically at an altitude of between 500 and 700 miles. The mid-course phase lasts 20 minutes and includes the time it takes for the released warhead to coast through space in an arc-like trajectory around the Earth. The terminal phase, or final stage, is incredibly short, just 1.6 minutes, 100 seconds. The terminal phase begins when the warhead re-enters Earth's atmosphere and ends when the nuclear weapon detonates on its target. The attacking Hwasong-17 in this scenario is a two-stage, liquid-fueled, road-mobile intercontinental ballistic missile. As of 2024, not a lot has been verified about its warhead capabilities, if it carries one or more nuclear warheads, if its payload is thermonuclear, and of what yield. What is known is that it can strike any target in the continental United States. The Jason scientists, 26 minutes and 40 seconds, launch to target calculation for Herb York was done in 1960, when the Soviet Union was the only other nuclear superpower in the world. Today, 9 countries possess nuclear weapons: the United States, Russia, France, China, the United Kingdom, Pakistan, India, Israel, and North Korea. Given North Korea's geographical location, the launch to target timeframe from the Korean Peninsula to the east coast of the United States is slightly longer. MIT Professor Emeritus Theodore Ted Postal has done the math for us. It is 33 minutes. The clock is ticking. In this scenario, 2 minutes have passed. Once launched, an ICBM cannot be recalled. The classified papers stashed away in Herb York's dusty archives forewarned the world of Armageddon, and here we are now. The ICBM threatens us with annihilation, York wrote. True in 1960, true today. 2 minutes, 30 seconds. U.S. Strategic Command, Nebraska. U.S. Strategic Command headquarters in Nebraska sits less than 10 miles south of Omaha, 2 miles west of the Missouri River. Its original name was Fort Crook. Ruinous regional weather includes tornadoes, cyclones, and floods. Deadly tornado funnels menace America's most important strategic nuclear headquarters with increasing regularity. In 2017, 10 aircraft were damaged when a tornado hit Offutt Air Force Base. The floods here are catastrophic. During the 2019 season, 700 Offutt airmen filled 235,000 sandbags in what was described by the Air Force Times as a valiant but ultimately unsuccessful effort to hold the waters back. Some 720 million gallons of sewage-infested waters flooded the base, ruining 137 buildings and destroying 1 million square feet of workspace, including 118,000 square feet of sensitive, compartmented information facility space, also known as SCIF space, for handling classified material. Half a mile of runway was submerged. The runway at Offutt Air Force Base is a critical piece of nuclear counterattack infrastructure, never more so than now in this scenario, with a nuclear-armed ICBM headed to the U.S. The runway here services the mini-fleet of America's airborne nuclear command posts, known ominously as its doomsday planes. These retrofitted Boeing aircraft are always at the ready, always prepared to command a nuclear war from the air. "Our military is very powerful, very lethal," says Captain Ryan Lawrence, an officer who manages the airmen on a doomsday plane. But it doesn't happen without communication. Inside the doomsday plane is where the STRATCOM commander can receive launch orders during a nuclear crisis, then execute those orders, even after America's nuclear command and control facilities on the ground have been destroyed. Which is why the STRATCOM commander is now hyper-focused on getting the blue impact or counterattack clock running. Then, on getting himself out of STRATCOM's underground bunker and into a doomsday plane that idles here on the tarmac, engines spinning, awaiting his arrival for takeoff. STRATCOM's Global Operations Center at Offutt Air Force Base is considered to be a top 10 nuclear target on every enemy's target list. But its commander won't leave the bunker until he speaks with the president first. Track data on the incoming ICBM has determined the missile's endpoint to be somewhere on the East Coast, presumably either New York City or Washington, D.C. But it will be another 2 to 3 minutes before the designated target becomes more precisely defined. 2 minutes, 45 seconds, National Military Command Center, Pentagon. Inside the nuclear command bunker beneath the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff discuss rapidly what the NORAD commander has just told them over video comms. An attacking ICBM appears headed for the east coast of the United States. The Secretary of Defense takes charge. Along with the chiefs of the other command facilities, he formulates what he might say to the president when asked. The individuals on this video call are men and women whose professional lives are dedicated to nuclear command and control, who live and breathe hypothetical nuclear war. Once ground radar confirms that an attacking ICBM is on its way to the East Coast, an impossibly dangerous next step feature of U.S. nuclear warfighting strategy comes to the fore. This feature centers around a decades-old policy called launch on warning. "Once we are warned of a nuclear attack, we prepare to launch," former Secretary of Defense William Perry tells us. "This is policy. We do not wait." Launch on warning policy is why and how America keeps a majority of its deployed nuclear arsenal on ready for launch status, also known as hair trigger alert. History lesson number 3, launch on warning. Launch on warning policy means America will launch its nuclear weapons once its early warning electronic sensor systems warn of an impending nuclear attack. Said differently, if notified of an impending attack, America will not wait and physically absorb a nuclear blow before launching its own nuclear weapons back at whoever was irrational enough to attack the United States. Launch on warning is a key aspect of nuclear war planning the public rarely hears about, says William Burr, a senior analyst at the National Security Archive at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Launch on warning, in place as policy since the height of the Cold War, is also incredibly high risk. Inexcusably dangerous, presidential advisor Paul Nitz warned us decades ago. Launch on warning during a time of intense crisis is a recipe for catastrophe, Nitz said. During the presidential campaign of George W. Bush in 2000, the future president vowed to address this perilous policy if elected. Keeping so many weapons on high alert may create unacceptable risks of accidental or unauthorized launch, Bush said. High alert, high trigger status is another unnecessary vestige of Cold War confrontation. No change was made. Barack Obama echoed the same fundamental concern during his campaign. Keeping nuclear weapons ready to launch on a moment's notice is a dangerous relic of the Cold War, Obama declared. Such policies increase the risk of catastrophic accidents or miscalculation. Like his predecessor, President Obama made no change. When President Biden took office, physicist Frank von Hippel urged him to eliminate the perilous policy. President Biden should end the launch-on-warning option and the danger it entails of an unintended nuclear Armageddon, von Hippel wrote in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. But like his predecessors, President Biden has made no change. And so, decades later, we're still here, with launch on warning in effect. 3 minutes. National Military Command Center, Pentagon. Inside the bunker beneath the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff consult with the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, a woman in this scenario, who, like General Ellen Pawlikowski, previously commanded the NRO Space Command in Colorado, as well as the Space and Missile System Center in California. Her experience makes her uniquely qualified to assess what is going on in this moment, just 3 minutes after launch of an ICBM from a field north of Pyongyang. The vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs has studied enough track data on launched North Korean ICBMs set to fly on preset trajectories so as to land in open water to recognize for herself that what she is looking at is not one of these preset trajectories. This missile's trajectory has it headed for the United States. Brilliant, fierce, and not known to mince words, the vice chairman points to the small, black ICBM avatar moving ominously across the screen. She inhales, exhales, addresses the Secretary of Defense directly. "You should get the president on comms," the vice chairman says. 3 minutes, 15 seconds, the White House, Washington, D.C. It's 3:06 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in this scenario, and the president is in the White House dining room, reading his midday briefing documents, drinking coffee, and eating an afternoon snack. He will not finish what he is doing. The national security advisor rushes into the room, phone in hand. He informs the president that the Secretary of Defense is calling from the National Military Command Center beneath the Pentagon, 2.1 miles away. The president puts the phone to his ear. The Secretary of Defense tells the president North Korea has launched an attacking missile at the U.S. It is a statement that at first seems implausible. The Secretary of Defense tells the president, NORAD and STRATCOM commanders have validated the assessment. We are awaiting secondary confirmation from ground radar in Alaska. The president turns to the National Security Advisor. He asks if this is some kind of a test. National Security Advisor, this is not a test. 3 minutes, 30 seconds. National Military Command Center, Pentagon. Beneath the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense watches the missile's trajectory as it moves across the massive screen in front of him. Just 3 minutes and 30 seconds have passed, 210 seconds, which means the ICBM missile is still in boost phase. The missile's avatar will soon cross North Korea's northern border into Chinese airspace. The job of the Secretary of Defense is to ensure civilian command of the military, a position that is second only to the president, who serves as the commander-in-chief. The Secretary of Defense and president are the only two civilian positions within the military chain of command. Standing beside the Secretary of Defense is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the nation's highest-ranking and most senior military officer. The chairman's job is to advise the president, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Council members, and others on military matters. The vice chairman is second to him. While the chairman of the Joint Chiefs outranks all other officers in the military, he or she does not and cannot command the military. The job is to advise the president and the Secretary of Defense, to help them decide what is best to do, what actions are the right next actions to take, including in a nuclear war. Everyone here in the underground National Military Command Center is intensely focused on the task at hand. Everyone is also in a state of shock. Everyone trained to act like they are not. A nuclear crisis is not a worst-case scenario. It is the worst-case scenario, the so-called unthinkable, and yet most definitely not unrehearsed. The ramifications regarding what is about to happen are almost impossible to comprehend. Nuclear war is unprecedented. Over decades, there have been several significant false alarms. In this scenario, what is happening is real. The president now faces an inexorably small decision-making window of time. What must happen next has been rehearsed by everyone presently in attendance on satellite comms, except most likely the president himself, former Secretary of Defense Perry, tells us. The president in this scenario, like almost all U.S. presidents since John F. Kennedy, is entirely underinformed about how to wage nuclear war when it happens. The president has no idea that as soon as he has been briefed on what is happening, he will have just 6 minutes to deliberate and decide which nuclear weapons to launch in response. 6 minutes. How is that even possible? 6 minutes is roughly the amount of time it takes to brew a 10-cup pot of coffee. As former President Ronald Reagan lamented in his memoirs, 6 minutes to decide how to respond to a blip on a radar scope and decide whether to release Armageddon? How could anyone apply reason at a time like that? Nuclear war, we are about to learn, robs man of reason. 4 minutes, the White House, Washington, D.C. The president is on his feet in the White House dining room, his cloth napkin on the floor. there are roughly 8 billion people on the planet. In the coming 6 minutes, the president will be asked to make a decision that can kill tens of millions of human beings on the other side of the world, just minutes, not hours, after his authorization. With launch on warning policy in effect and nuclear war on the horizon, so much hangs in the balance. Civilization as we know it is about to end. Former Secretary of Defense Perry tells us of such a moment as this. This is not an exaggeration, he says. Here in the White House, the National Security Advisor stands a few feet from the president. He is trying to get a North Korean official on the phone when he is knocked into by the special agent in charge of the presidential protective detail. Of all the people in the room prepared for crisis response, the Secret Service agents on the president's detail are among the best rehearsed. Day in and day out, the U.S. Secret Service trains for this. Into the emergency bunker now, the special agent in charge shouts at the president. Members of the detail hover close by, the agents all speaking into their ear and hand comms in sync. There is a flurry of activity. Two Secret Service agents grab the president by his armpits, his hand still clutching his cell phone. The generals and admirals who are watching all this on satellite comms sit or stand in their respective bunkers while waiting on the president's every word. The emergency plans book, the National Security Advisor says. Keep him with the satchel, says the special agent in charge. We're taking him to the sit room. The president does not fully comprehend all that is going on, how fast a nuclear counterattack must unfold. This hasn't fully landed with him yet. No one, not even the president, has complete knowledge of what is going on in a crisis zone or in a conflict, let alone in nuclear war, says John Wolfthal, a former National Security Advisor to President Obama. Many presidents come to the office uninformed about their role in a nuclear war, former Secretary of Defense Perry explains. Some seem not to want to know. Once, at a press conference in 1982, President Reagan went so far as to incorrectly tell the public that submarine ballistic missiles are recallable. After the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union was dissolved, William Perry found in his experience as Secretary of Defense that many people clung to the idea that nuclear war was no longer a threat, when in fact, he says now, nothing could be farther from the truth. In a nuclear war, confusion over protocol and speed of action will have unintended consequences beyond anyone's grasp. It will send the United States of America into the heart of darkness that defense official John Rubel warned about in 1960, into what he called a twilight underworld governed by disciplined, meticulous, and energetically mindless groupthink aimed at wiping out half the people living on nearly one-third of the Earth's surface. History lesson number 4, ICBM launch systems. The Hwasong-17 missile on its way to Washington, D.C. in this scenario was road mobile, meaning it got carried to its launch site by a 22-wheeled vehicle called a transporter erector launcher. The missile itself stands 85 feet tall. In its nose cone, it carries a warhead bus that may or may not include dummy or fake warheads designed to confuse America's missile defense systems that are about to try to shoot it down. In 2021, defense analysts predicted 50% of North Korea's ICBMs would succeed in hitting their targets inside the U.S. In 2022, Japan's defense minister publicly confirmed the Hwasong-17 can travel 9,320 miles, far enough to reach the continental United States. The Hwasong-17 ICBM is too heavy to drive around the countryside along North Korea's cheaply paved roads, and so it gets driven on dirt roads along sturdy ground, no recent rain or snow. The U.S. does not have road mobile missile launchers. All 400 of its ICBM missiles are housed in underground silos across America. Most U.S. citizens do not accept as reasonable a road mobile missile loaded with nuclear warheads being driven through their town or city, past their homes, or near where their children go to school. Road mobile rocket launch pads, invented by Nazi rocket scientists circa 1944, give North Korea a strategic advantage. Whereas the precise location of all 400 of the ICBM silos in America is available on the internet and on maps before that, North Korea's road mobile ICBMs are continually on the move, so the Defense Department cannot easily target them for destruction before or during nuclear war. At Buckley Space Force Base in Colorado, analysts with NRO's Aerospace Data Facility examine satellite imagery from the minutes and hours before the missile launched off the truck bed parked in the dirt field. They confirm its identity as a Hwasong-17. Looking back at NRO's satellite images from earlier in time, analysts can see it was being transported along a dirt road to its launch location 20 miles north of Pyongyang. While very little is known about the Hwasong-17's warhead capabilities, quite a lot is known about its rocket motor, the RD-250, including that it is Russian-made. In November 2017, North Korea first flew an ICBM powered by this motor, which led four missile experts, American scientist Richard Garwin and MIT Professor Emeritus Ted Postel, along with German rocket engineers Marcus Schiller and Robert Schmucker, to sound an alarm. The Russian engine was probably stolen from a storage unit after the Soviet Union collapsed, Postel tells us, later sold to North Korea. Theft of nuclear weapons and their delivery systems is often how nations accelerate their fledgling nuclear programs. Property theft saves a nation not just time but treasure by avoiding complex research and development programs. Back in the 1940s, after Klaus Fuchs stole blueprints for the atomic bomb dropped on Nagasaki, he gave them to his handler in Moscow. From that moment, it was only a matter of time before Stalin had his own atomic bomb. Until the Hwasong-17's Russian RD-250 rocket engine was put into play, says Postel, North Korea couldn't get a missile anywhere near the east coast of the United States. This likely theft by North Korea fast-tracked in just 4 months a technical development that would have taken the Hermit Kingdom decades to accomplish, he says. Ted Postel and Richard Garwin warned colleagues about North Korea's capability in a 2017 paper. Postel is an expert on missile technology, a former advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations, and Professor Emeritus at MIT. Richard Garwin, having drawn the plans for the world's first thermonuclear bomb, knows as much or more about nuclear weapons as anyone else alive. Garwin has been at the fore of nuclear weapons development and national security ever since. He worked on developing the world's first spy satellites and is considered one of the 10 founders of the National Reconnaissance Office. In their 2017 paper, Garwin and Postol argue that because of North Korea's particular geographical location, traditional missile defense against their ICBM is near to impossible. There are blind spots around the North Pole, they write in their paper, and propose that the best way to defend against the Hwasong-17 is to fly armed MQ-9 Reaper drones, the big-wing variant built during the War on Terror, over the Sea of Japan, close to North Korea's coast, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, ready to take out an attacking missile 240 to 290 seconds into flight, Postol clarifies. This time frame is imperative because just a few seconds later, the ICBM will complete powered flight and go dark, meaning it can no longer be seen and tracked by early warning space satellites. Satellites can only see hot rocket exhaust, says Postol. They cannot see the rocket after the rocket motor stops. This is a dark black hole in national defense against ICBMs, Postol and Garwin warn. 4 minutes, 30 seconds. Stratcom headquarters, Nebraska. Everyone at Stratcom has eyes on tracking screens. 4 minutes and 30 seconds have passed since the launch of the Hwasong-17. The ICBM is now in its last few seconds of boost phase. Once the missile enters mid-course phase, it becomes almost impossible to stop. Now is the last opportunity to shoot down the attacking ICBM, but this cannot happen because the U.S. Defense Department has no system in place. We told all kinds of people in D.C. about this, and all of them disregarded the idea, Postol tells us. We proposed a joint initiative with Russia, Garwin reveals. They also have an interest in keeping North Korea from launching a nuclear weapon, just as we do. But Postol's and Garwin's suggestions fell on deaf ears. There are no Reaper drones presently patrolling over the Sea of Japan to try to shoot down this attacking ICBM. 275 seconds pass, 285, 295. The rocket motor burns out. Boost phase ends. The Hwasong-17 releases its warhead, which continues ascent. Mid-course phase begins. The multi-billion dollar SBIRS constellation of early warning satellites can no longer see what remains of the North Korean ICBM. It can no longer see the nuclear warhead en route to the United States. The warhead has gone ballistic and is now all but invisible to the satellite's sensors, coasting as it is on a high-speed trajectory to an apogee or high point somewhere over planet Earth. 5 minutes, U.S. Missile Defense Agency headquarters, Fort Belvoir, Virginia. 12 miles south of the Pentagon, at Fort Belvoir in Virginia, personnel at the Missile Defense Agency's headquarters command center are freaking out. There is a myth among Americans that the U.S. can easily shoot down an incoming attacking ICBM. Presidents, congresspeople, defense officials, and countless others in the military-industrial complex have all said as much. This is simply not true. The U.S. Missile Defense Agency is the organization responsible for shooting down incoming missiles in mid-flight. Its flagship system, the Ground-Based Mid-Course Defense System, was built in the wake of North Korea's accelerated ICBM program that began in the early 2000s. The U.S. system centers around 44 interceptor missiles, each one 54 feet tall and designed to hit a fast-flying nuclear warhead with a 140-pound projectile called an exo-atmospheric kill vehicle. The incoming North Korean warhead will be traveling at speeds of around 14,000 miles per hour, while the interceptor's kill vehicle will be traveling at speeds of around 20,000 miles per hour, making this action, if successful, akin to shooting a bullet with a bullet, according to the Missile Defense Agency's spokesperson. From 2010 to 2013, not a single one of the early interceptor tests was successful. Not one. The following year, the U.S. Government Accountability Office reported the system was not really operational because its development was flawed, that each interceptor missile was only capable of intercepting a simple threat in a limited way. After 5 years and many billions of U.S. tax dollars spent, 9 out of 20 hit-to-kill U.S. interceptor tests failed, which means there is only an approximate 55% chance that a Hwasong-17 will be shot down before it reaches its target. At any given time, these 44 interceptor kill vehicles are on alert, siloed at two separate locations in the continental United States. 40 of these missiles are located in Alaska at Fort Greely, and 4 are located in California at Vandenberg Space Force Base near Santa Barbara. 44 missiles total. That is it. The intercept sequence is a 10-step process, 3 of which, in this scenario, have already happened by now. 1. The enemy has launched an attacking missile. 2. Space-based infrared satellites have detected the launch. 3. Ground-based early warning radars have tracked the attacking missile through boost phase until mid-course phase begins. The attacking North Korean missile now releases its warhead and decoys so as to confuse the sensor system on the exo-atmospheric kill vehicle that is attempting to track, by sensors and an onboard computer, and intercept it. Distinguishing between a single warhead and other possible warheads and decoys in the warhead bus poses a new set of challenges for the U.S. Missile Defense Agency. These are challenges that must be dealt with in seconds, not minutes. For this, attention moves out to sea to the classified $10 billion sea-based X-band radar station known as the SBX. 6 minutes, north of Kure Atoll, North Pacific Ocean. 20 miles north of the coral-ringed Kure Atoll, floating in the vast North Pacific Ocean, more than 1,500 miles from Honolulu, the SBX radar station is a sight to behold. This one-of-a-kind, stadium-sized, seagoing, self-propelled radar station weighs 50,000 tons, requires 1.9 million gallons of gas to run, can withstand 30-foot-tall waves, is larger than a football field, rises 26 stories out of the ocean, requires 86 crew members to carry out its mission, and claims to be the most sophisticated phased array electromechanically steered X-band radar system in the world. The original platform of the SBX was built by a Norwegian company that specializes in offshore vessels for oil drilling. It was purchased by the U.S. Defense Department and modified. Now it houses the world's most expensive missile defense radar, its bridge, workspaces, control rooms, living quarters, power-generating areas, and a helicopter pad. The SBX was sold to Congress by leaders of the Missile Defense Agency as the most capable system of its kind, able to detect, track, and discriminate incoming missile threats. One catchy descriptor that SBX advocates use to explain how powerful the SBX is to say, if placed in the Chesapeake Bay, its radars would be able to see a baseball-sized object in San Francisco from an observation post in Washington, D.C., some 2,900 miles away. This is true, sort of. The baseball needs to be hovering 870 miles above San Francisco, in a direct line of sight with the radar in D.C., in order to be seen. The goal of the SBX is to provide U.S. interceptor missiles with precise data about where an attacking nuclear warhead is in the atmosphere in mid-course phase flight. Inside a very small window of time, as in seconds. Most Americans have never heard of the SBX and have no idea about its strengths or its flaws. Mike Corbett, a retired Air Force colonel who oversaw the program for 3 years, had, by 2017, already predicted it would fail. "You can spend an awful lot of money and end up with nothing," Corbett told the Los Angeles Times in 2015. Billions and billions were spent on these SBX programs that didn't lead anywhere. Critics call the SBX radar system the Pentagon's $10 billion radar gone bad. By the time most people learn firsthand of the SBX's litany of flaws, it will be far too late. 7 minutes. U.S. Army Space and Missile Defense Command, Fort Greely, Alaska. To discern a nuclear warhead from a decoy is the job of the one-of-a-kind SBX radar system at sea. It is what taxpayers have paid billions of dollars to develop and hundreds of millions more annually to maintain. A recent Congressional Budget Office report indicates Pentagon missile defense costs from 2020 to 2029 could reach $176 billion. In this critical moment, 7 minutes after an attacking missile has been launched from Asia at the United States, U.S. national defense depends entirely on the exo-atmospheric kill vehicle inside the interceptor missile, communicating with the SBX radar system in order to determine what it must hit to kill. Here in the Alaskan wilderness, 100 miles southeast of Fairbanks, a set of clamshell-shaped silo doors blast open. A 50,000-pound, 54-foot-tall interceptor missile fires up into the air from the U.S. Army Space and Missile Defense Command, Fort Greely, with an explosive howl. In the history of warfare, the goal in battle is to meet attacking sword with defensive shield. The intention of the interceptor missile system is to shield the continental United States from a limited nuclear attack. Limited is the key word here, because the total number of interceptor missiles is 44. As of early 2024, Russia has 1,674 deployed nuclear weapons, the majority of which are on ready-for-launch status. China has a stockpile of more than 500. Pakistan and India each have around 165. North Korea has around 50. With 44 missiles in its entire inventory, the U.S. interceptor program is mostly for show. In press photographs released by the Missile Defense Agency, a rising interceptor missile in action is presented as glamorous-looking and powerful, with a plume of fire and smoke trailing out behind an ascending rocket body on a backdrop of purple sky. In reality, it is far from salvational. As the interceptor rises into space, its onboard sensors communicate with radar systems on the ground and at sea in a process known as telemetry, the remote collection, measurement, and relay of data. When the interceptor missile completes its own boost phase, its exo-atmospheric kill vehicle separates from its rocket body and continues on ascent. This, allegedly, is the shield. This is what promises to keep an attacking missile from striking a target in the United States. There is no other shield. This is it. Hit to kill means it must collide with the warhead to destroy it in flight, Richard Garwin clarifies. Missile expert Tom Caracco anthropomorphizes the process, explaining that now is when the kill vehicle would open its eyes, unbuckle its seatbelt, and get to work. But the real-world capabilities of a warhead on a Hwasong-17 suggest there could be up to 5 decoys contained in its warhead bus. Will the interceptor succeed or fail? 9 minutes. Clear Space Force Station, Alaska. Roughly 100 miles west of the interceptor missile fields at Fort Greely, the powerful long-range discrimination radar at Clear Space Force Station gets its first sight of the attacking missile as it comes over the horizon. The Defense Department calls Alaska the most strategic place in the world when it comes to ballistic missile defense, and says that its long-range radar has the necessary field of view to detect incoming threats. 9 minutes have passed. Inside the classified Fire Direction Center, an airman seated at a desk picks up the red phone in front of her. "This is clear," she says. "Site report is valid. Number of objects is 1. The dreaded secondary confirmation of an attacking ICBM headed to the east coast of the United States has just been made. The facility here in Alaska is one of several early warning ground radar facilities keeping watch for nuclear attack since the early days of the Cold War. Other facilities like it are located in California at Beale Air Force Base, Massachusetts at Cape Cod Space Force Station, North Dakota at Cavalier Space Force Station, Greenland at Bedufik Space Base, formerly Thule Air Base, United Kingdom at Royal Air Force Fylingdales. For decades, these ground radar systems the size of small pyramids have been relied on to scan the skies for an incoming ballistic missile attack. To air is human, but machines also make mistakes. These same systems have been responsible for several near-catastrophic false alarms. Once in the 1950s, early warning radars interpreted a flock of swans as a fleet of Russian MiG fighter jets en route to the U.S. by way of the North Pole. In October 1960, computers at the ground radar site in Thule, Greenland, misread the moon rising up over Norway as being the radar returns from 1,000 attacking ICBMs. In 1979, a simulation test tape, mistakenly inserted into a NORAD computer, deceived analysts into thinking the U.S. was under attack by Russian nuclear-armed ICBMs and nuclear ballistic submarines. Former Secretary of Defense Perry tells us about the sheer madness involved when a person's brain tries to process the horrific supposition that America is actually under nuclear attack. The NORAD test tape debacle happened on Perry's watch. He was Under Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering at the time. And for a few short minutes, he prepared to notify then-President Jimmy Carter that the dreaded time had come, that the president needed to launch a nuclear counterattack. Instead, that early warning notification turned out to be notification of a phantom attack. What came through on the computer was a simulation of an actual attack, Perry remembers. It looked very, very real. So real that he actually believed it was real. But back in 1979, instead of waking up President Carter in the middle of the night, as was Perry's job, the chief nuclear watch officer on duty at NORAD that night dug into it further and concluded it was an error, Perry explains. For several terrifying minutes, William Perry believed nuclear war was about to begin. I'll never forget that night, he tells us, now in his 90s, and that right now we are closer to having a nuclear war happen, even by accident, than we were during the Cold War. The scenario presented here is not fear-mongering, Perry confirms, that rather it should be understood as entirely possible of happening. In the 21st century, U.S. satellite systems have replaced ground systems as the initial bell ringer in a sneak nuclear attack. Ground radar stations around the world exist to provide secondary confirmation regarding what the nuclear command and control system ostensibly already knows. What the Fire Direction Center has just reported in this scenario is not a simulation tape, a flock of swans, or the rising moon. It is real. 9:10, U.S. Army Space and Missile Defense Command, Fort Greely, Alaska. The U.S. Army Space and Missile Defense Command at Fort Greely and the Clear Space Force Station in Anderson sit roughly 100 miles apart from each other as the crow flies. In this intense moment of missile defense, everyone at both bases is focused on precisely the same action, shooting down the attacking ICBM with an interceptor missile. Hundreds of miles above, up in space, the interceptor completes powered flight. Its boosters burn out and fall away. The exo-atmospheric kill vehicle in the nose cone is let loose and begins seeking the Hwasong 17's nuclear warhead by using sensors, an onboard computer, and a rocket motor designed to steer it to its target. The final step in the interception process has begun. The kill vehicle hurtles through space at a velocity of around 15,000 miles per hour. It opens its infrared eyes and tries to locate the target, tries to find a signal from the warhead's warm surface on an otherwise dark background of space. Once the kill vehicle locates what it thinks is the warhead, attempting to destroy it is an even more radical challenge. To destroy the warhead as it hurtles through space, the kill vehicle must rely on its own propulsive energy and an extremely precise physical collision.